Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. We've established to our satisfaction that the aparusheya shabda pramana of the Vedas should be our main authority for knowing, for gaining spiritual knowledge. But now we're going to read some contrary considerations presented by Vachaspati Mishra, who is a famous scholar of the 9th century AD. He wrote books, textbooks, commentaries on several different darshanas, but he's a prominent Mayavadi. Okay, I'll read. Atra vachaspatischaivam aha nacha jyeshta pramana pratyaksha virodad amnayasyaiva tadapekshyasyai apramanyam upacharitartatvam veti yuktam asya paurusheyataya nirasta samasta dosha shankasya bodhakataya chasvatak siddha pramana bhavasya svakarya pramitau parana pekshatvat. So, translation. In this regard, Vachaspati Mishra says, nor is it reasonable to say. Now he's going to present somebody else's Purvapaksha and answer it. He is a Vedantist. He's a Mayavadi, but he still belongs to the Vedanta school. And someone from some other school raises an objection, which he deals with. I'm not sure who the other person is supposed to be, what school of thought he's coming from. I don't think I have that. Anyway, he says, nor is it reasonable to say that when scripture, which depends on its elder sensory perception, contradicts sensory perception, it loses its authority, or else must be understood in a figurative way. Argument is that pratyaksha, sensory perception, is elder. That means it came first. And the premise, unspoken premise, is what came first is superior, like the elder brother, has authority over the younger brother. So when Purvapaksha is saying, when shabda, when scripture contradicts your sensory perception, it's the scripture, which is comes second, it's subsequent. Therefore, it's not primary authority. It has to be rejected or understood in a figurative sense. That's the Purvapaksha. Vachaspati Mishra says, this idea is unreasonable because scripture is self-evident authority. Having no human author, and being an awakener to knowledge from which all fear of fault has been dispelled. Scripture depends on no other evidence to yield its result, valid knowledge. Scripture is self-evident. It doesn't depend on agreement with any other, even its older brother, Pratyaksha. Okay, but that's not the end of the argument. Purvapaksha comes back again. Pramitav anapekshatvaipi utpattau pratyakshapekshatvad tadvirodad anutpatti lakshanam asya apramanyam iti chin na iti chet na iti chet. The Purvapakshas typically begin with nanu. You can also signal the end of the Purvapaksha with chet, if somebody says, if. And then usually chet, and then the next word is na. No, you're wrong. So, iti chin na utpadaka pratidvandvitvat. Dvandvitvat, P. I'm sorry, P for period. Period. Okay, let's read that sentence. It might be said in response that even though scripture is independent in providing valid knowledge, this is the Purvapaksha again, even though scripture is independent in providing valid knowledge, its coming into being still depends on sensory perception. Well, it does, doesn't it? You need to hear or see the text. Otherwise, you have no access to it. Its coming into being still depends on sensory perception. And so when scripture goes against sensory perception, it loses its authority because it doesn't even come into being. Well, okay. Vachaspati answers that. Let me read one more sentence of the Sanskrit before I read the English, because I stopped too early. Nahyagama gyanam samvyaviharikam pratyakshasya pramanyam upahanti yena karana bhavan nabhavin apitu tatvikam. Answer to the Purvapaksha by Vachaspati Mishra. This suggestion is wrong. For what helps bring forth Shabda has no power to go against Shabda. Scriptural evidence does not defeat the ordinary authority of sensory perception, for then Scripture would have no cause and would not come into being. Yeah. Rather, what Scripture defeats is the absolute authority of sensory truth. One thing, one distinction we should make. We, without perceiving, we have no access to Shabda Praman. It doesn't awaken in our heart. We don't recognize it. That's not the same as it's not existing. The Shabda Praman exists whether we perceive it or not. That's one thing. Now what Vajrasbhati Mishra is saying here is, okay, pratyaksha helps bring forth Shabda. It means for you, you recognize Shabda by pratyaksha. But still it has no power to contradict Shabda. And scriptural evidence is defeating Shabda, is defeating pratyaksha, not completely defeating it, not defeating its ordinary authority. Shabda tells us there's a mad bull running right at you. Pratyaksha tells you that. You see a big bull running right toward you. Shabda Praman doesn't say, no, there's no bull. It doesn't contradict. Ordinary sensory perception within its scope is not contradicted by Shabda. Because if it did, then if scripture completely denied the authority of pratyaksha, then you couldn't perceive the scripture. Then pratyaksha would be a totally unreliable means. You can never trust anything pratyaksha tells you. because it's been contradicted by Shabda. But then you could never know Shabda without reliable perception. I think the book says this, but I can't trust my perception. Maybe it really says something exactly the opposite. So you have to... Anyway, scripture doesn't completely deny the authority of Shabda, of Pratyaksha. Rather, what scripture defeats is the absolute authority of sensory truth. That means two things, that it's not completely true, and it's not true about absolute transcendental things, spiritual things. It doesn't have the scope to go beyond a certain range of reality. The transcendental reality beyond what the senses can see, the senses have no authority about. So they have no absolute authority in that sense. They have no authority in the absolute realm. Okay, more. Nacha tasyot padakam atatvika pramana bhave bhyopi sam vyavahara ke bhyas tatvagyanot patidarshanat Yata varne rasva dirgatwadayo anyadharma api samaropitas tatva praptipatti hetavaha nahi laukika naga iti va nogo iti va padat kunjanam tarumva pratipadyamana bhavanti brantaha. It is not I'm sorry, I have to make... Please give me 30 seconds. I have to make a comment here to myself. It is not that sensory perception as an absolute authority gives rise to scriptural authority. Indeed, we see that true knowledge is sometimes brought forth even from ordinary sources of knowing that have no absolute authority. For example, even though the shortness, length, and other features of phonemes are qualities foreign to them, when superimposed on phonemes, they become causes of definite understanding. Common people are certainly not mistaken when they understand from the words naga and nuga the respective ideas of elephant and tree. Nor is it reasonable to propose a figurative meaning for a statement that already has an unequivocal meaning of its own. Let me go back to the Sanskrit. Nacha nanya param vakyam swarta uparichartarte kartam yuktam uktam hi navidau parak shabdartaha iti jeshtam chana pekshitasya badyatve hetur natu badakatve rajita gyanasya jayasaha shukti gyanena kaniyasa badadarshanat tad anapabadane, tad apabadatmanas, tasyot pater, anut pati. Nor is it reasonable to propose, because the proposal was that when Pratyaksha doesn't agree with, or when, let's say, Shabda does not agree with Pratyaksha, the Shabda came first, therefore it should have priority, and the Pratyaksha has to either be the Shabda has to be dismissed or understood in a figurative sense. So what about understanding in a figurative sense? Nor is it reasonable. We're answering no. Nor is it reasonable to propose a figurative meaning for a statement that already has an unequivocal meaning of its own. Shabda, the statements of scripture, have their own definite meanings. The words mean what they mean. Why do you need to change it into some other meaning, figurative meaning, when the sentences that compose the scriptures have direct meanings? They're not some sort of, in most cases, sometimes they are, some sort of very esoteric poetry that makes no sense in a literal way. Most of the Shruti makes direct sense. Why do you have to twist it and squeeze out a secondary figurative meaning from it just to make it agree with Pratyaksha? Just like the absolute truth is eternal. Statement of scripture. But my experience is that nothing's eternal. Everything decays and meets an end. Everything. So when the scripture tells me that, that must be figurative. Just like the demigods are called Amaras. But they're not really immortal. So the absolute truth, figuratively, is said to be immortal. But to match with my experience, I have to conclude that it's not really eternal. Just lives for a long time. Eventually the absolute truth will die also. Someone could argue like that. But scripture says the absolute truth has no beginning and no end. That's a definite meaning. You may not like the meaning, but it says something directly. Why do you have to change the meaning? To make it figurative, to match with your so important experience. As it has been said, the words of injunctions do not assume extra meanings. Who said that? Let's see. Let's go back and find it. Z8. I don't know. I think it's Shabrabhasya, the commentary on Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutras. Shabara, I think, says this, that the words of injunctions don't assume extra meanings. They mean what they mean, and you don't need to impose a figurative or some other secondary meaning. I'm sorry, Gaur Mohan. Don't distract. Please, Gaur. Vajaspati goes on arguing against interpreting the Vedas figuratively to make them match your experience. He says the effect of a prior perception when something is misunderstood is not that it puts an end to the latter, to a latter mistaken one, but rather the other way around, that when mistaken it is put to an end itself. See, the assumption was that Pratyaksha is older, so therefore it has more authority. But it doesn't work that way. If your first impression is wrong, it's corrected by the second impression. When you think you see a snake, and then later you find out it's really an oyster shell. Oh, sorry, no, I got mixed up. It's a rope. Then the second impression has contradicted and corrected the first impression. The second impression, the second idea has priority. So the effect of a prior perception when something is misunderstood is not that it puts an end to the latter mistaken one, but it's the other way around. It's mistaken and it gets corrected. But rather that when mistaken, it is put to an end itself. For example, the later perception of oyster shell ends the prior perception of silver. If the prior perception were not subject to being ended, the perception that ends it would not even arise. If there is no way to convince you that you don't actually see an oyster, that you don't actually see any silver, if you were stuck on silver and never could, you know, get away from that impression, then you'd never see it as an oyster shell. You wouldn't be able to. But once you can see it as an oyster shell, then the wrong impression of silver is defeated. So that goes back to the beginning of the Purvapaksha, the basic assumption that Prajaksha is more authoritative because it comes first. No, the wrong thing can come first, and it's corrected by the second thing, the second evidence. You know, there was a murder committed, and we saw so-and-so come out of the apartment building just after the murder. And so we arrest him, and he's a prime suspect. But later on, it's proven that he didn't do it. Someone else did it. So the second evidence corrects the first wrong evidence. Okay. Darshitam cha tatvika pramana bhava syana pekshitatvam tatacha paramarsham sutram parva par ye purvadaur balyam prakriti vad iti tata parva parya baliyastvam tatranama pratiyate anyonya nirapekshanam yatra janma diyam bhavit. We have already shown that a means of absolute knowledge does not depend on anything else for its existence. A means of absolute knowledge doesn't depend. Well, how many means of absolute knowledge do we have? How many do we know about? Means of absolute, of knowing the absolute. Basically the Vedas, and later on you can see with your own eyes, pratyakshavagamam, but primary evidence is aparusheya shabda. And so that aparusheya shabda doesn't depend on anything else for its existence. We already discussed that. And as stated in a sutra by a great sage, and the great sage is Jaimini himself and the Purva Mimamsa. This is one of the sutras. Between a prior command and a later one, the prior is weaker, as in the case of a prototype ritual. When you have two commands, injunctions, do this, and then later you said, do that, and they're contrary. You know, offer 5 rice cakes, and then later it tells you, offer 7 rice cakes. Which one is right? They can't both be right. Should you offer 5 and 7, make 12? No, it's got to be either 5 or 7 rice cakes to be offered. First injunction said 5. Second injunction said 7. Well, the first injunction is in the original such and such sacrifice, the prototype. And then there's a variation on that sacrifice in which you offer 7 instead of 5. And so the injunction for the variations of the sacrifice says 7. So the injunction 7 overrules the original injunction for the prototype. Of five. As in the case of a prototype ritual, between a prior command and a later one, the prior is weaker. The earlier one is weaker. And furthermore, it has been said, and that's by Kumarala Bhatta in his Tantra Vartika. He has 2 commentaries. Kumarala Bhatta is one of the founders of the one of the 3 major schools, sub-branches of the Purva Mimamsa Sampradaya. Kumarala Bhatta. He wrote 2 different commentaries. One on the first chapter, 12 chapters. There's only 4 chapters in the Vedanta Sutra, but there's 12 chapters in the Purva Mimamsa Sutras. So on the first couple of chapters, I don't remember how many, he wrote in verse form a commentary called Shloka Vartika.
And then, and the rest of it, the other one's also in verse form, but it's a different book, Tantravartika, on the rest of the Purimimamsa. Tantravartika is an extremely difficult book to read, but it's in verse form. And this is a quotation coming from the Tantravartika on the later part of the Purimimamsa from which this sutra comes. And he says, only, this is explanation, only when ideas arise that are independent of one another is the relative strength of prior and latter observed. Let's see if we can explain that. Like, I see silver, or I see an oyster shell. Those are two independent perceptions. It's not that when I see silver, on top of that, I'll also see it's an oyster shell. I can't, because it's contradictory. Either you see one or the other, and they're independent perceptions. You perceive them under different conditions that are independent. But, like, I see a snake, and the contrary independent perception is, no, I see a rope. You know, when your brain switches over to a different gear, and you see the light changes, and you see, oh, no, it's a rope. An independent perception. But suppose I see a snake, and he looks angry, and he might bite me. That's the second perception. That's not independent. Based on the fact that I see a snake, it's moving like this. You know, maybe it's going to bite me. That's my second perception. It's a dependent perception. If I thought first it's a rope, and the wind was blowing it back and forth, I wouldn't be worried about the rope biting me. So that, the case of seeing, after seeing a snake, then seeing the snake is looks like he's about to bite, that's a dependent perception. In that case, there's no question of which one is right and which one is wrong. If one's right, they're both right. Well, anyway, it's not a question of it has to be one or the other. It's one on top of another one. So only when the ideas are independent, when ideas arise that are independent, do we have the question of which one is stronger. Does it matter which one is stronger and which one's weaker? Then we have to choose one or the other, snake or rope. That's Kumaralabhata's explaining what Jaimini meant, but usually, as usual, Kumaralabhata, by explaining things, makes them more complicated. Anyway, all of this has been said by Vachaspati Mishra. He's quoted all these Purvimimamsas, although I think he's writing all of this in his Mayavadi Vedanta commentary in the Bhamati. This is all a quotation from Bhamati. Yeah, it's the introduction to the Bhamati, I think. Z9, I had to. Okay, there's a commentary. I'll read it, and then we'll open for discussion. Commentary says, Vachaspati Mishra, who lived in the 10th century, okay, 900s AD, wrote the Bhamati. That's his Vedanta Sutra commentary. Why does it have the name Bhamati? No, it's the name of his wife. Yeah. Named after his wife. She helped him. Maybe she did a lot of the writing. Here cited at length from its introductory words. It is one of the most influential commentaries on Shankara's Advaita Vada interpretation on the Vedanta Sutras. Its impersonal philosophical viewpoint is unacceptable to Vaishnavas, but Srila Jiva still cites this passage as authoritative on the technical topic of the Vedas being independent of other pramanas. This is Sarvasamvadini. This is where Jiva Goswami digs in down into what everybody has to say about everything. Just to completely, Prabhupada says, discuss it threadbare. He continues, Scripture may claim absolute authority, but a person becomes aware of scriptural knowledge only by hearing or reading, which naturally involves perceiving with the senses. Doesn't that reduce Scripture to a secondary authority, dependent on sensory perception? No, Vachaspati argues. We do have to rely on our senses to receive the statements of Scripture, but the statements themselves are independent. Whether we perceive them correctly or not, or whether we even perceive them at all, they are always true. The truth, therefore, is that Scripture is more powerful than sense perception. But even though Scripture may overrule our mind and senses in special cases, the authority of sensory perception, pratyaksha pramana, within its ordinary limits, is still valid. In other words, perception derived through the senses need not be perfect to be a source from which we can derive our scriptural understanding. Axiomatic for all proponents of Vedic authority is the idea that the original sound of the Vedas is eternal, as are the phonemes, the individual sounds that comprise the words of the Vedas. Narayanad udbhutoyam varnakramaha. That's not here. But that Jiva Goswami also said that. These aksharas, infallible syllables, are the prototypes. When people chant the Vedic mantras, or even when they speak in ordinary language, the sounds they produce are reflections, copies of the original aksharas. As far as impersonalists like Vachaspati Mishra are concerned, words cannot actually express absolute truth. Now, as a Mayavadi, he doesn't believe that the words of the Vedas can directly describe the absolute truth. Can't be done. But only point toward it indirectly. In the same way that metaphors in poetry implies something left unexpressed. Vachaspati, therefore, following the philosophical lead of Bhartrahari and his monistic linguists, considers less than absolutely real the physical features of spoken language. That means the words, the letters, are not real, they're illusion. According to the Mayavadis and according to this special grammatical school of grammatical Mayavadis, founded by Bhartrahari, who wrote the Vakyapadiya. And he had his followers in later generations. They had a special kind of Shabda Advaita. The absolute truth is one without a second, no qualities, and it's sound. It's the sound of the Vedas. The ultimate aksharas are real, but their reflections in human speech are only useful expansions of illusion. That's Mayavadis talking. Nonetheless, Vachaspati reasons, we all rely on the conventional illusion of language for obtaining knowledge from words and statements. Even though the words we hear and speak are products of Maya, they empower us to live our lives and can direct us toward the absolute truth. Again, this is Mayavadi's talking. Experts in the theory of Sanskrit poetry explain the figurative use of words, a use they term lakshana, when words are used in such a way that their literal meanings cannot literally apply. One must resort to the extended meaning supplied by lakshana. For example, someone may talk about Ganga Yam Goshaha, a cowherd village on the Ganga. Since a village cannot literally stand in the water of a river, the intended idea must be that the location of the village is somewhere connected with the river, somewhere connected with the river, namely on its bank. This poetic usage serves the purpose of subtly attributing to the village qualities of the river, such as its purity and coolness. Those who propose that sensory perception, pratyaksha, can overrule scriptural authority are saying that the Vedas, in order to conform to the dictates of empiric knowledge, must submit to similar poetic interpretations. But Vachaspati defends the independence of a Paurusheya Shabda. He argues that when a statement's literal meaning is not blocked by circumstance, there is no need and no justification for resorting to an indirect meaning. He cites from Shabara's ancient commentary on Jaimini, that was there, that when the injunctions don't assume extra meanings. He cites from Shabara's ancient commentary on Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutras the hermeneutic rule that one should understand Vedic injunctions in their literal sense without reinterpretation. What happens when scripture and the experience of our senses disagree with one another? Does the sensory knowledge have priority because it came first? After all, no text can be understood without first being seen or heard. Our experience tells us that bones are unclean. But then the Vedas tell us that a conch, the external skeleton of a mollusk, is pure. Doesn't the idea received through the senses invalidate the idea received from Scripture? If in principle it were the other way around, and Scripture were to invalidate the authority of the senses, we would learn nothing from the Scriptures, because it is through the senses that we perceive what the Scriptures say. That's the Purvapaksha. Vachaspati says, no, this is a spurious argument. When the Vedas overrule experience about the purity of a conch, they are not denying altogether the ability of the senses and mind to receive and decipher the words of the Vedas, but the competence of the senses and mind to make judgments about things beyond sensory and mental scope. Besides, if one wishes to argue that sensory perception has greater authority because sensory experience through which one receives the Vedic knowledge must come first, one's basic premise is wrong. That's Sarupa Siddha Hetu Abbas. Your general principle is just not right. It's not right at all. So it's not a good argument, because your reason is wrong. It's just not true. The general rule is that a later perception corrects a previous wrong one, not the earlier one correcting the later. Jaimini's sutra affirms this. Jaimini mentions the example of a prototype sacrifice, like the simple daily pravargya offering of milk to the sacred fire in a Brahmin's home. This same pravargya ritual also appears in a more elaborate form in the great soma sacrifices of the Vedas. In the prescriptions for the more elaborate rituals, whatever details differ from those of the original prototype can be assumed to supersede the original. Tantravartika, the 7th century Mimamsa commentary by Kumarila Bhatta, further comments on this point. Kumarila reasons that questions such as whether a prior or later understanding has greater authority are relevant. Those questions are relevant only when such understandings are independent of one another. That is, when they arise in different conditions of awareness. For example, when one wrongly perceives an oyster shell to be silver, one's understanding of silver is conceived in illusion. The later, correct understanding of silver is born in a clearer frame of mind. So those are two independent perceptions. In contrast to all other kinds of praman, a Paurusheya Shabda is always independent and free from error. Therefore, to propose that another pramana has priority over the scripture, Vedic scripture, makes no sense. Okay, so we've taken help from the Mayavadi Vachaspati Mishra to make this point. Anything in there that's totally confusing, or any questions or doubts? Yes, sir.
I'm just trying to understand why why he in the text says the point about the varnas and the things imposed on them. I'm just trying to find it. Again, when Naga, that paragraph, like, what's the connection with the whole argument?
Okay, one second.
The connection is that pratyaksha is used to perceive shabda, even though pratyaksha is imperfect. And it can be demonstrated that an imperfect means of perception can help you get access to a perfect one. As in all perception of scripture, according to the Mayavadis, words and the sounds that make them up are not real. The Shabda Brahma is one without a second. It has no divisions. The splitting up language into sentences and words and letters is illusory. It's a fiction. Convenient fiction, but a fiction, an illusion. Grammar is just an illusion. The relevance is to show a well-known case in which an imperfect means of knowing gives us access to a perfect means of knowing. We perceive the words, we hear the sounds, and we make sense of the words, and then we can make sense of the words put together into sentences, and then we have an idea of what the Vedas are saying. That's using the illusion of letters, words, and sentences to access the real message of the Vedas. But that's the way the Mayavadis see it, but it helps provide a good example. We say that the letters and the words and the sentences are real. We don't go along with the idea that they're Maya.
So basically, nowhere in this piece of argument, their Mayavadi philosophy is somewhere evident. It's just technical point.
Nowhere what?
In this piece of argument, Mayavada philosophy is directly evident.
Directly evident. Well, that's a sign of Mayavad. When you say that letters and words and sentences are illusion, that's Mayavadi talking.
But it's not mentioned in the text.
Well,
so
but you know who's talking. It's Vajrasamati Mitra. He's a Mayavadi.
But I mean to say that the whole points mentioned in this piece of argument are we can accept them fully and like without.
Oh. Well, we can't accept that. That part we don't accept.
But it's not mentioned here in the text, in the main text.
It is the fact that the aksharas are illusory. He mentions that, and we don't agree with that. One second, let me find it. Yata varni rasva dirghatvarayo anya dharma asaropitas. So the shortness and longness, which are qualities of phonemes of aksharas. Some aksharas are short and some are long.
Okay.
You learned that at the beginning of Harinam Vyakarana. Some vowels are long and some are short. That longness and shortness are illusory qualities of illusory aksharas. That's what he says here. They're samaropitas. That's the Mayavadi terminology for a false conception, like the snakeness being imposed on the rope. So longness and shortness is being imposed on these illusory aksharas that don't exist in the first place. So he's talking like a Mayavadi there in that sentence. We would have to, before we would say the same thing, we'd have to correct that, we wouldn't say they're illusory. He's saying they're illusory. Yes.
Oh, actually, maybe I just mentioned something first. Vartika, I'm just noticing on Tattva Savagya Puru's computer that it's only got one T there. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so, okay. Anyway, I can mention that later on. But yeah, about the Varnas, interesting is that I just recently translated Jiva Goswami's commentary to one verse in the 11th canto where he explains all the Varnas in detail in a different way than how he does in Harinamrita Vyakarana.
Yes.
And because Panini in his sutras, the Pratyahara sutras, and he has like Ayun, he doesn't make a difference between long and short and Pluta and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's basically only one sound, and it's, you know, how you can you know, it's just the same sound. It's just length and so on, it's just different qualities which are...
Yes. It's assuming different qualities.
Yeah.
The same, but they're real qualities.
They are real qualities.
Yeah, we accept them to be real qualities, not imaginary ones.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're just saying that it's like, that it's imposed. But it's...
How many phonemes do you have then?
He counts 63 in this other way.
Including merging together the short and long vowels?
Well, he counts the varieties.
So then he counts the varieties, yeah.
Yeah. And he counts out some other things also. Yeah.
But they're real. The qualities are real.
Yeah, yeah.
There is somewhere one quotation was there that if the injunctions are direct, they should not be... twisted. What is that exactly?
I didn't say if they're direct. I said if the meaning can be understood directly, if they have a literal meaning. If they have an understandable literal meaning, and he's assuming that they do. The injunctions have literal meanings, therefore you don't need to give them figurative meanings.
So that's,
you know, I tell you... please go put some air in the tire. You don't have to speculate, you know, what's the mystic significance of that? You know, what's the poetic significance of that? What is he trying to indicate about his, what he feels about life? No, he needs air in the tire. So the injunction is put air in the tire. Don't impose on that a figurative meaning. You don't need to. And in general, in poetry, Lakshanavritti is allowed only when the... Abhida, or direct meaning, doesn't work. When it's blocked, then you're allowed to resort to Lakshana. But it's never blocked in the Vedic injunctions. The literal meaning always makes sense.
But, so this is Vachaspati Mishra who's giving an answer to the Purva Paksha, right?
Yes.
But he himself, in the Mayavada school, they are doing this to the maximum extent of distorting the direct meanings of the scriptures. So on what basis that he, how does he have any guts to say?
Well, you know, I think because we're talking in two different realms of the scripture. There are the injunctions, and then there are the artavads, various explanations and glorifications. So all that the, at least according to the Mimamsakas, everything that the Vedas have to say about an absolute truth is under the category not of vidhi, of injunction, because it's discussing something unknown. It's discussing rather than what you should do. When the Vedas are describing the absolute truth, it's describing a truth that already exists. It doesn't say, go make an absolute truth. Go concoct an absolute truth for yourself. It's saying the absolute truth is there, even before you existed, even before you were there as you. The absolute truth is eternal. So it's stating description of existing fact rather than of something that should be done. Injunction means something doesn't exist yet. The sacrifice hasn't been done yet, and you should do it. That's an injunction. But when you describe what already is a reality, that's not an injunction. That's artavad. It's one kind of artavad, which according to Jaimini is of no real significance. But according to Vedantists, that's where the real significance is, the description of the absolute truth. But it's a different category, a different department of Vedic descriptions apart from injunctions. So what we're talking about here is injunctions, not about descriptions of the absolute truth.
Just like the Upanishads might say that one should meditate upon the formless absolute truth, something like that.
Well, that's an injunction, okay.
So then there comes here the interpretation of what this absolute, the formless nirguna brahmam is.
Yes.
So there, both parties interpret according to their own schools of thought, like this Vajra.
Well, no, but the interpretation is not what the injunction is. The injunction is just meditate on the absolute truth, not meditate on chocolate ice cream. You know, not that for me, chocolate ice cream is the absolute truth. I'll meditate on chocolate ice cream. No, meditate. Find the absolute truth and meditate on it. Now, there are unanswered questions. What is the absolute truth and where is it? Where do I find it? That's one question. What is the absolute truth? Where is it? And second, how do I meditate on it? What's the details of things that should be done that comprise the act of meditating? Those questions have to be answered, and there's a room of interpretation about that. But the injunction is simple. Meditate on the absolute truth. Either agree with that or don't, but there's no room for interpretation. Either do it or don't. You know, but then you have questions about what's the absolute truth, where do I find the absolute truth, and how do I actually go about meditating on it? There you have so much room for interpretation. Yes.
There's one example for this, how there are injunctions and there could be a tendency to extrapolate it to mean extra, to give extra meanings. Like when the yajamana is not there, you can keep a plant in place of yajamana. So if that's the injunction, then if
you can give a plant instead of what?
You can keep a plant in place of the yajamana.
Oh, if the yajamana is not there.
If the yajamana is not there for the sacrifice. So,
well, that's an alternative.
That's an injunction. So, if somebody wants to extrapolate, wants to extract a meaning from that to say that, okay, so in place of the yajamana, you can keep a plant. So that means everything is actually same, or the plant is same as the yajamana. Then if they want to
well,
get some meaning out like that.
Well, but that's your attempt at philosophizing on the esoteric meaning. But the injunction is straightforward.
That's it.
You know, it just says put a plant there. And when you don't have a yajamana around, when he's missing, put the plant there in his place. It doesn't say anything about the, you know, the identity of the plant and the yajaman. That's your speculation. That's not what the injunction is saying.
That would be putting extra meanings to the...
Yeah, and it shouldn't be done. Or there's no need to do it. Not as far as understanding it as an injunction. If you want to go beyond injunction and analyze it as poetry, you know, what the poetic ramifications the Vedic mantras have, you know, let's look at them as poetry. You can, but that's going beyond looking at them as what they actually are, just injunctions. Just put the plant there. Don't worry about what the plant means. Just do it. And then if you want to, afterwards, when the sacrifice is done, you can speculate. But first of all, do the sacrifice. And in the brahmanas, you do get such speculations. You know, this represents this, that represents that. Even in the Yajurveda, the Advayu priest is, you know, just doing his job, but he tells the pot, clay pot, O pot, you are the womb of Aditi. You are the womb of the earth. So that's an interpretation, but it's supplied by the... That's artivat, that's not injunction. He's talking to the pot and glorifying it. And their authorized interpretation is being given by the Veda itself, by the Yajurveda. But that's the nature of artivad. Time's up. Last question.
Just if the definition of vidhi, because I noticed Jiva Goswami's explanation is also coming from Mimamsa. He says that vidhi means agyata gyapanam prashanam cha. So it could mean like informing about something which is not known. Or it could mean like
agyata gyapanam.
And I saw that in Artha Sangraha, that's what Jiva Goswami was getting from Mimamsa.
That's a broad definition that goes beyond what the Mimamsa considers vidhi.
Oh, is it?
Uh-huh. Because agyata gyapanam could also mean telling you why Indra is so great, or identifying the absolute truth, he's like this, he's like that, that's a gyata gyapanam. But according to Mimamsa, that's artivat, not vidhi.
Okay.
So that's a non-technical, broad idea of vidhi.
So
but Mimamsa would be more strict about what they consider vidhi.
Okay, so then
vidhi, according to Mimamsa, is to tell you to do something that hasn't been done. Something needs to be done, and you're being encouraged to do it.
Boss.
Yeah.
So Artha Sangraha, is it not pure mamamsa, or it's just kind of like more general? Artha Sangraha, this book, Artha Sangraha.
Artha Sangraha is supposed to be straight mimamsa. It's a simple introduction to mimamsa. Why? There, the vidhi is divine word.
Yeah, that's
right. Word.
Yeah, that's, he said that. Gyata Gyapanam there.
Ah. Okay, but we have to, you know, we have to see how that's explained in the commentary.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think the meaning is actually limited and focused on injunction and what we consider injunction.
Right, right.
Because in vidhi always has to do with some bhavana. That means inspiring some desire to do something in the hearer. Mm-hmm. It's the purpose of the vidhi.
Yeah.
If nothing needs to be done, then what kind of vidhi is it?
Yeah.
You know. You know, you say an inspiring thing. Radha Shyama Sundar are very beautiful this morning. And I say, yes, they are very beautiful. But there's no injunction there. Of course, there may be implied injunction. Go see them. You know, you haven't taken darshan yet. Go see them. There may be an implied injunction. Okay, we'll stop here. Is there still any unsettled doubts that we have to deal with tomorrow, or should we proceed? Do we need to discuss more of this tomorrow morning? Okay, we'll move ahead. Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.